Okay, shall we begin? So if you remember from last time, we were talking about climate, and in particular the sun, and how understanding the way the sun moves through the sky, the various seasons of the year, the differences between winter sun and summer sun, the paths through the sky, how that can be this powerful tool for making a building far more energy efficient, having an enormous impact on the amount of energy consumed in keeping the building temperate, heated, or cooled. At the end of that session, I ask you, if you're gonna buy a house, say 10 years from now, how high a priority would it be for you that the house is climate responsive, that it's very, very attuned to the physical environment around it, and therefore energy efficient. So here are a number of your responses. Some people felt like it was a very, very high priority. For example, someone says the wars of the future will be fought over environmental concerns. So my house's energy efficiency will be one of my highest priorities. Someone else said high priority. The main reason I chose to take this course was to gain an understanding of architecture so I can someday build a green and energy efficient building that works in harmony with nature. Someone else says, being a little older, I've already purchased my first house, and my electric bills are massive despite my house being north-facing with decent tree cover. I can't imagine what the bills would be like if it were west-facing without tree cover. If I were to build a house now, these issues would all be a high priority for me. A house with good thermal considerations will allow me to enjoy the natural climate more often than simply keeping the AC 7 to 70 all day. How boring to me now. Someone else said, these issues are not a priority. Oh, sorry. Let me see. That. Let's get the high priority first. Someone else says, I'm going to buy the right house that responds to the climate well. It's a huge priority, because I want to conserve energy and use as many natural ways as possible to maintain the climate of my house. I want to reduce my carbon footprint. Someone else says, it's going to be the highest priority. My dream home is one carved out of a shipping container deep within a forest in the Pacific Northwest, and I need to be self-sustainable. I want it to be well-oriented and ventilated, so I do not need any artificial heating and cooling. I want rainwater collecting systems and solar panels. I want the house to be one with nature, just like I am. Then there were some people who were kind of moderate on this. Someone said, it's a secondary priority for me. Climate should definitely be a focus of the home, but it must respond well in other aspects, like space and form. I couldn't picture everyday life in a passive solar home, but it would be equally strange if temperature factors were completely ignored for the sake of visual beauty. Someone else said, it will be a priority, but definitely not a top priority. It obviously helps save on energy bills. However, I feel like making it a top priority can take away from some of the aesthetic appeal of the house. Someone else says, honestly, I think it's a moderate priority. I want a house made entirely of windows, and if that doesn't work with the climate, so be it. Someone else says, thermal and energy efficiency will be a high priority for me, but maybe not the highest. Price, function, location, aesthetic appeal, will all be high on my list. Thermal efficiency is important to me because I want to have a small carbon footprint and teach my children to do the same. Raising them in an energy efficient house would be a good start. Someone else says, it'll be a priority, but maybe not the highest priority because as long as we have sources of energy, they can still be used to heat and cool down houses. And then some people thought it was a pretty low priority. Someone said, these issues are not a priority at all for me. When buying a house, I'm going to care about where it is located in relation to where I work, not whether it fulfills these issues or not. I would always use blinds or just air condition my house a lot instead of thinking about these issues. I'd rather spend more money on air conditioning than finding a house to suit these issues. And finally, someone says, as a person that rarely stays in my house, this is not a priority. By the time I buy a house, heating and cooling will probably be more efficient, so all this passive stuff isn't really necessary. If I want a thermal experience, I'll go outside with a sleeping bag. So, as you can see, there's a wide diversity of point of view on this topic in this class, and I'm fascinated by that. So one thing that I think I may have left a wrong impression about in class the other day, I showed you all those passive solar houses, and I showed you ones from the 1960s and 70s, and they're very, very diagrammatic. And I mentioned at the time that they tend, I can show them because they so clearly say orientation and sunshading and all of those things. But I thought, you know, maybe I left the wrong impression. Let me show you a more mature passive solar home that doesn't say it so in your face, but in fact is extremely, extremely energy efficient. So this is a house in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Little bit different climate than here. It's colder in the winter, and it's not quite as hot in the summer. So they have more heating days, a lot more heating days than we do, and somewhat less cooling days. This house is long and thin rectangle, long faces north and south, short faces east and west. It's on a slope, a very steep slope, that goes down like that. There's a kind of cliff right there. The top of the hill is a good ways up there. But there was this cliff and a slightly level area, and the house was placed on that slightly level area and created a little courtyard on the south side here that would catch some sun so you could be outdoors on the sunny side of the house in the wintertime. And most of the glass is on the north or the south face, as you'll see, and there is horizontal sunshading on that south window, as you can see right there. So massing, fenestration, sunshading, all of those things are working very much with all the principles we talked about last time. Now, on the other side of the house, it goes down the hill dramatically. So the hill slopes off. It's long and thin in this direction. Long faces north and south. This is the north side of the building. There's a trellis here, but it's not solid, so that you can get the north light in there. But it blocks the west light, just like that building we saw in Australia, the Cameron offices. So it makes a nice shady terrace on the north side of the building. So the whole living room, dining room, kitchen, which are right through here, those are all open on one side to this sunny court to the south, and open on the other side to this dramatic view to the north. And on each side, there's 60-foot long glass walls that then open up completely so that you can see out to that long view in that direction, open out to that courtyard there, and really you're just in a natural environment. Now, the house is also made substantially of rammed earth walls. That's what's happening right there. And in particular, these rammed earth walls, which you see there, are on either side of the sitter of the house. And so this is an area with a high diurnal swing. It might be 40 degrees at night. It might be 90 degrees during the day. Very big extremes. And so what you do is you open all those windows up at night. And if you want to put screens, there are screens that slide out there too if you want to keep the bugs out. But you open it up at night and it cools off those high thermal mass walls. And in the morning, you shut those glass doors, and those walls air condition your house during the day. So when it gets to be 90 degrees, those walls are still, they're high thermal mass, and they're still cool, and they cool the house during the day. So even on a summer day, often, they don't need to use the air conditioning at all.
and there is this real kind of communication with nature. Then in this direction, there's a 70-mile view out to this beautiful valley and then the hills in the distance, and that's that downhill view to the north. And you can see the north light that comes in above the trellis, comes in below the trellis, the west light controlled by the slats of the trellis right there, and this complete indoor-outdoor connection. That's what those rammed earth walls look like. Essentially, the house is heated and cooled with dirt. Dirt that you can find right around that site. This is in northern New Mexico. Actually, the dirt came from a little town called Abiquiu, which is maybe 40 miles away. But there are four different colors of soil that are in that. And the way they make it is they layer up the soil and they ram it down and they layer more soil and ram it down and it becomes just as hard as concrete. But it has this beautiful, soft texture to it. And it is about 18 inches thick, so it's a very, very high thermal mass wall in the house. Now, I'm going to make the argument that this is not ugly. That in fact, you can have a very high performance passive solar house that is aesthetically very, very pleasing. Now, in this case, this is very near a zero net energy house. They have a big photovoltaic field that produces a fair amount of energy there. They have a very, very precise monitoring system in the house. So there's a little display, and the owner of the house can get it on his smartphone, and he can see exactly what temperature it is outside, what temperature it is on any individual room inside, or as a composite, what the average temperature is inside the house. And then it can see for any time of the day, any day of the year, what amount the air conditioning was on or what amount the heating was on. There is air conditioning in the house and there is heating in the house. The heating is a radiant heating that's put in the slab of the floor, and so it just radiates the heat. It's not ducted heat. And the air conditioning is very, very, never have to use it too much, but there is a modest amount of air conditioning there. So he can track and see exactly what consumption of energy there is. In addition to that, under this terrace right here is a huge rainwater collection system, so that every bit of rain that falls on impervious cover, that is the roof or any terrace or driveway of the house, every drop of that is collected into a rainwater collection system, and that's used for any kind of irrigation they have on the site. That means that what might otherwise have created erosion now goes to distribute that water in a more even way, not all at once, but as they need it over a longer period of time. In addition, there are green roofs on the house so that there's very, very high insulation in the ceiling because it's actually under dirt with native grasses that grow on it and need very little water. And that also provides, instead of the heat island effect that comes when the sun hits on a hard surface and absorbs that heat, instead they're the grasses that have a cooler surface on the top of the house. So basically, I'm just saying that those houses I showed were very diagrammatically passive solar, but there are other ways to do passive solar houses that don't scream at you, maybe, quite the same sustainable message. Okay, so let's, that's just a kind of, just to make sure I didn't leave the wrong impression last lecture. I would like now to talk a little about our quiz that's coming up and a little about the book. So we have a quiz coming up next Tuesday, and it will be exactly the same format as the first quiz. There will be three parts. The first part will be slide identification. That ought to be familiar territory for you at this point. The second part will be multiple choice questions. There will be 10 of those. Five will be on the book. Five will be on the lectures. Similar format, and I think there's a sample test that's up on the website, so you can check that out. And then the third part will be two of the essay questions that were handed out last time. Let me talk a little about how I would study for the five multiple choice questions that are on the book. You should know the point of view that Lisa Hsiong is taking. She has a very, very strong point of view, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. But you should know her point of view. You should also know parts of the book that talk about things we talked about in class, especially the class last Tuesday. So these passive solar houses, you should know something about how those work. She was involved in designing some of those in her early career. She talks about that. Just those things we talked about on Tuesday where there was an overlap between the subject matter of the class and the subject matter of the book. But substantially, you should just know what her point of view is. So let's talk just a minute about her point of view. I don't by any means expect you to swallow her point of view. If all of you believed what Lisa Hsiong believes, you would not be living the way you live today, because we do tend to live in a way where we go from one air-conditioned environment to another air-conditioned environment to another air-conditioned environment to another air-conditioned environment. We tend to condition most of the spaces we inhabit. And she's saying, not only is that very energy-consuming and bad from that point of view, but she's saying that's not as much fun. That's not as enjoyable. That is a diminution of the way our bodies want to behave in a thermal environment. She says that our bodies like extremes of heat and cold sometimes, and that actually living with those kinds of cycles can be energizing and stimulating and a wonderful experience. Now, I don't expect you to believe that, or to say, yes, that's what I want. But I want you to think about it. Is that possible? I mean, it's relatively small amount of time. We're talking about 30 or 40 years when we felt like we had to be at 72 degrees all the time. Prior to that, for millennia, human beings existed in warmer temperatures and colder temperatures, and they really had no desire to stay steady state at 72 degrees. Even, there certainly was heating and air conditioning before 30 or 40 years ago. There wasn't really air conditioning before the 1930s at all, anywhere. There might have been some, you know, evaporative cooling systems. There were fans. There were things like that. But there was not air conditioning. So your grandparents, when they were growing up, in Texas, if they grew up in Texas, they sweated in the summertime. And that was just a normal way of being. But now we tend to think maybe that's not comfortable. That's not right. So it's just something to think about. And, you know, these are the kinds of differences it could make. Maybe as we get into summertime here, just these next couple of months, if you live in a house and you have control over your heating and air conditioning, let's say you did not turn on the air conditioning until June 15th. No air conditioning until June 15th. There will be some 90, 92 degree days in there, and inside your house it'll be 80, 85 degrees. And you'll have to strip down to, you know, sandals and shorts and t-shirt, and you'll still sweat a little bit. But, you know, not so bad. And then maybe come June 15th, you kick on that air conditioner. Okay, I'm not gonna really sweat. I'm not gonna be uncomfortable when I go to sleep at night and not be able to sleep. That would be a modest step in the direction that Lisa Hsiong is talking about. And it would save you a whole lot on your energy bill. That energy bill in May and June, that could have a big impact. And that's dollars in your pocket you can spend for something else. It's just something to think about. But honestly, these days, we pretty much don't think about it. We just set that thing at 72 degrees and then scream when that energy bill comes. Oh, my God, look how big that is. But they still leave your thermostat at 72 degrees, just torquing away. So, something to think about. And the Twitter card question at the end of class today is going to be, three options. One option is, I love what Lisa Hsiang says. I totally embrace that. I need to change the way I operate. I think this is really correct. I do think there's something to this, and I want to learn from that. That's option number one. Option number two is, I kind of get it. I think there's something to that. I'm going to think about it, but I'm certainly not in agreement with what I consider to be a kind of radical position she has. Or the third option is, this woman is full of shit. I am not going there. This is progress. I mean, we're better. I don't want to go back. What's this woman talking about? She's nuts. So those are three options. So just tell me your Twitter card. How do you feel about the position Lisa Hsiang is taking here? Okay, so the lecture today is about a synthesis of all of these issues of physical considerations. And the point here is that, yes, you can do these things individually. You can deal with structure and materials. You can deal with, the building and the relationship of the building and the land. You can deal with climate issues. But really, to thoroughly think through all of these physical considerations, it takes a synthesis of that. The building needs to hit all these bases at the same time. And so we're really looking at what kind of architecture comes out of a real consciousness of the building existing in this natural physical world and taking full advantage of all of those issues. And we're going to look at a few buildings that I think do this exquisitely and do it as a composite across all these issues. So the first of these is the Dominus Winery in Napa Valley in California. The architects are Herzog and Demeron, Swiss architects who were brought over from Switzerland to do this building. It's the first building they did in the United States. They're very, very famous architects now. This was one of their first kind of breakthrough important buildings. And it actually is a weird building. It's a little industrial building. It's a place where they manufacture wine. This is not even a winery where you go and, have tasting and the tourists come and they, have the little sales shop and all that. They don't have any of that here. This is not about selling wine. This is strictly a place for making wine. So the Dominus name is a very familiar one in Europe. It's a very famous French vintner. And they were a little disappointed by the fact that in these big wine competitions, they were getting their butt kicked by these California wines. They're these snotty French vintners, and they think French wine is the best. And then they go to these competitions, and completely blind taste testing, people are saying, ooh, that California wine tastes better than your pissy little French wine. And, apoplectic. And they realize that the problem is that the California soil and the California climate produces a kind of grape they simply cannot produce in France. The Napa Valley is this very famous place for growing wines, grape for wine, and it's just got the perfect soil and the perfect climate. Its physical considerations are ideal for making wine. So this snotty French vintner gives up, comes to California and buys a piece of land in the Napa Valley in order to grow the grapes to make better wine than they can make in France. So this soil is super precious, and they bought the perfect soil in the Napa Valley, and they bought it in a climatic region that is just right for raising grapes for wine. So I went to see this building with Christian Mouet, who is the head of Dominus Wines. And this is a guy, probably in his late 40s, early 50s, when I was walking through this project with him. And he is a connoisseur of wine. He considers himself to be an artist. He is making art. He is making this incredible wine that is extraordinarily expensive. It's the finest wine in the world. And watching him cradled those grapes in his hand, watching him talk about his craft. He understands physical considerations at an incredible level. He is all about soil and climate and sun and seasons and weather and wind and rain. All of those things are absolutely essential in the art he practices, which is winemaking. And what he wanted in a building was he wanted architecture that did the same thing, that looked at physical considerations like soil and wind and sun and light and structure and mass and those physical considerations, and made art, made magic out of that. So he hires Herzog and Dimeron to do that. They're a perfect architect for him. They're all over physical considerations, have been all of their career. So the Napa Valley in this particular area is, it's a valley. It's got hills on both sides. The range of hills run east and west. So it's an east-west range of hills here. Then there's the valley and the Napa River and an east-west range of hills here. And it's that valley in between that has this spectacular soil. So they ran the building, long faces north and south, short faces east and west, and parallel to those ranges of mountains. So it fits with the land beautifully. You can see the range of hills behind the building. It's running parallel to them. The river is just behind us in the photograph on the left. And so it just fits linearly into this valley perfectly. It also is made of a material that makes it almost disappear in the landscape. You can see that the texture of the building and the texture of the trees behind it are virtually the same. It's not very far off of the highway, but many people pass by and don't even know there's a building there. And you point out to them, well, you know, the Dominus Winery, it's a very big building, but it's almost invisible in that landscape, which is kind of a miracle given, you know, what a big building it is and what a relatively delicate landscape it is. The rows of vines run the length of the valley as well. So the building is just completely integral with the agricultural landscape as well. It's parallel to the rows of the vines. The vines are placed that way so they can catch all the south light and get as much sun on the grapes as possible. And the building is oriented that way for the sun as well. So the grapes and the building want really the same orientation to the sun. So it is made primarily of stone, and we'll look at it in more detail later. But it's the stones they picked up on the ground right around there. It's exactly the same stone and exactly the same color as the soil. And of course, when you start to farm an area, you need to take the rocks out of the ground. So in the process of really preparing it for making agricultural land, they had to pull the rocks out anyway. They used those rocks to build the building. So definitely relationship to the land. That first lecture we had, very powerful, very integral. Even the way you hold up the grapes is this kind of metal armature. And the building also has a metal armature that holds up the stones. The stones are not laid in mortar. They're in what are called gabions, G-A-B-I-O-N-S. They're metal cages that have the rocks inside them. And there's a very nice kind of dialogue between the metal armature for the plants and the metal armature for the building. So, relationship to land, very powerful. The second lecture we had was on geography, topography, ecology. And we were talking about things like soil and soil erosion and rainfall and impervious cover and all those issues. Huge concern here. They want as little impervious cover as possible. The soil is super, super sensitive and super precious to them. So really the only impervious cover is a drive that goes to the building, just two lanes so a truck can go either direction, and the footprint of the building itself. Otherwise, there is no impervious cover on the entire site. Minimize the roadways, minimize any kind of transportation necessity, just the most direct route right into the building and the minimum building footprint itself. And you can see that the soil, the agricultural soil, goes right straight up to the building. No outdoor patios or no pads for air conditioning, or all of that stuff is kept to an absolute minimum. Another very clever thing they do here is when you get the runoff from a building, say from the roof, and you're collecting it, and then maybe you have a gutter and you have a downspout, and often that will concentrate water as it moves across soil, and there's a possibility of erosion. Oh my God, not this precious soil. You're not going to erode anything here. It's very important that that soil not have any rivulets or erosion in it. So what they do is they take the water off the roof and they send it down those cages of stone. They just drop it into that cage of stone, and the water splish splashes around and becomes this little fine mist, so that by the time it reaches the ground, it's just a real fine mist that distributes itself on that ground below. And there is zero erosion, complete dispersion of that water. No matter how heavy the rainfall is, it's going to distribute it in a very, very gentle way. So extremely respectful of geography, topography, ecology. They're even worried about critters. So they were thinking, okay, we make these gabions with the rocks and the cages. You know, how is that going to be for, will mice nest there? Mice love grapes. And snakes love grapes. And so you don't want snakes and mice nesting in there and gnawing on your grapes. So they actually make the mesh a little denser at the bottom, so no critters will be going in there, and then it becomes lighter at the top when you're not vulnerable to those kind of critters. Okay, so first two lectures. The third lecture, we talked about structure and materials. How is the building made? And we talked about bearing systems, and we talked about bending systems. And this building is actually made of both, and the application is extremely appropriate. When you need bearing systems, you get bearing systems. When you need bending systems, you get bending systems. Bearing systems use certain materials. Bending systems use other materials. So in this case, the bearing systems are these big concrete walls. They are also high thermal mass walls. We'll talk about that in a minute, but they're trying to keep this wine as it's being produced at a very stable temperature, and they're trying to use natural means to do that. So they, around the areas where they're either, where they're manufacturing the wine, it tends to be very thick bearing walls made out of concrete with high thermal mass that gives them both the structural capacity and also the thermal performance. But then there are other areas where you need to drive trucks through, or maybe where the offices are, and they need to be much more open, and there need to be views and breezes, and you need to maneuver trucks around. So those are made out of bending systems, frame systems, and of course the appropriate material there is steel, far better in bending, and so that works in that part of the building. And it's even exposed, so the ceilings tend to be this very thin wire mesh, and up there you can see the framing of the structural system very explicitly up above. There's some of the office areas where you get that. You know, when you're in the offices, you don't want heavy, massive walls. It's absolutely beautiful views out of this building. They want openness, so they have a frame system, as you can see there. Big open porches, floor-to-ceiling glass. That's completely different from the areas that are for manufacturing the wine itself, where they have these big tanks. And those are all solid concrete walls, and they're completely dense, as you see there. And that's got that high thermal mass and is keeping very stable temperature in those areas of the building that have that kind of demand. And so there's a real contrast between the light, airy, delicate parts of the building where they're maneuvering trucks on the left, or where they're having offices and even outdoor conference rooms and things like that on the right. And the two different systems work very compatibly with the kind of functions that exist there. And they reinforce the functions and they perform their structural job extraordinarily well. Big difference between the concrete parts of the building and the open and light steel parts of the building. Okay, then let's talk about climatic response. Long faces north and south, short faces east and west, that's perfect. All the fenestration, 100%, is on those long north-south faces. So where you need windows and views out, as you do here at the offices, they're on that long south face right there. And those windows then get sunshading, horizontal sunshading, that comes down there. And even then, there is the porch itself, which is a sunshade then for the glass that exists in the offices back behind it. So you've got beautiful layering of sunshading that occurs there. You've got the high thermal mass I was talking about in those big concrete walls. And those are, the sun shines on it all day long. High diurnal swing here, so maybe it's 80, 90 degrees during the day. The sun's shining on those stones, it's heating it up. Then at night, the temperature drops dramatically, gets down to 40 degrees at night, and that stone is re-radiating that heat back through that high thermal mass concrete wall and keeping the temperature stable. And that's what makes these big areas where they're storing the wine and trying to keep it stable, temperate all the time. Now, Herzog and Dimeron wanted to have no heating and no air conditioning in the building. They swore to the client, we can do this all passively. And yet the client is this prissy, fussy guy who wants his wine at exactly the temperature he wants his wine. And so he forced them to put air conditioning and heating in the building. But I was there maybe 6 months after it was open, and they said they'd never turned on their heating or their air conditioning. The building was doing its job all by itself with no heating and air conditioning. And especially these rooms were the ones they were worried about. They have to stay, it's not 72 degrees, it's more like 62 degrees. And they had calibrated everything so they stayed very, very stable without any heating or any air conditioning. The other thing that's just incredible is these are just magical walls with those gabions. The light comes in these little bitty pinpricks, and it reflects off of this glass. This wall on the right is a west-facing wall. And I was there when it was sunset, and the sun is going down low in the sky, and the light is then coming in horizontally through those little gaps in the stones. And then it's shining on that glass wall of the offices. And then as the sun began to go behind the hills, it made, you know how in an eclipse, when the moon goes over the sun, and if you have a little hole and you have the light go through there, it makes a crescent? Well, it was making little crescents on that glass wall. It was just gorgeous. The aesthetic effect that came from some of these thermal devices was really beautiful and really extraordinary. We had lunch that day in that little conference area there. Outdoors, why not be outdoors? It's beautiful and pleasant, and pretty temperate climate there. And we're having lunch outdoors and you're seeing into the vineyards and the business and the meeting we were having, all having to do very much with each other. Wow. Just a great kind of communion with nature. So, I think pretty much hits all the bases in terms of physical considerations. A second building, very, very different building type. And we're gonna now go to Australia, where we looked a little bit last time. And this is a house by Glenn Murcutt. Glenn Murcutt is an architect for whom physical considerations are extraordinarily, extraordinarily important. This is a guy who eats, lives, breathes physical considerations. He's won the Pritzker Prize. He's one of the most renowned architects in the world. He has a tiny little one-person practice. He doesn't work with anybody else. He just does these buildings by himself in Sydney, Australia. And so Glenn Murcutt did this little house. It's out in the outback, very rural part of Australia, maybe 60, 70 miles west of Sydney. And it's in an area that is all eucalyptus forest. And it's pretty much in the middle of nowhere. There's just a little, dirt road almost that goes into this area. And in fact, construction was kind of an issue because there was really no access road that you could take a big truck in or anything like that. A pickup could go in, but you know, a concrete truck was hard to get in, and any kind of like 18-wheeler was hard to get in. So there were real restrictions on access to the site. And it was just a beautiful, beautiful natural environment. The client was an economist, a guy named Professor Lee, who taught at University of Sydney. And his economic theory is about resource management. And basically, he's an economist that says that healthy economies in the future are all about managing resources and not overconsumption of resources. So as an economist, he's believing in sustainability. And so he thinks, well, I guess if I'm going to build my own house, I need to practice what I preach, and I need to have resource conservation in my house. So he builds this house, and he's retiring. When he was building the house, he was retiring from University of Sydney. He, at a relatively young age, he was maybe in his 50s. And the idea was he would go out and live in this beautiful natural environment, and he would write these books about economics and about resource management. So the building and the ideas are meant to be one with each other. So they're in this eucalyptus forest. There's a kind of hill that is flowing down in the slide on the left. The uphill is to the right, downhill is to the left. They break the building into two smaller pieces, so it's a little more delicate in this environment, two little pieces that make up the house. There it is, parallel to the contours, laying in the land very gently. Long faces north and south, short faces east and west. You know, as I said, Australia, they're upside down, so we're going to call this the south face of the house. It's actually the north face of the house, but it behaves like our southern face. And there's the deep overhangs that you can see there as well. Now, it also opens up to the landscape quite thoroughly. It also has, as with the house we looked at earlier, a big wall that just slides over here and nests all those panels there, or they can be pulled out, either screens or glass, to close that off. But pretty much in every part of the house, it just opens up to the landscape, and it feels like you're camping out in this deep primordial wood. The eucalyptus trees are very beautiful trees, very feathery, light trees, and because the ground falls off, you're kind of in the canopy of the eucalyptus trees. There's no dramatic views. You're just in the middle of the forest and kind of looking into the tree canopy all the way around the house. In terms of geography, topography, ecology, so, you know, obviously building and the land working very nicely together. In terms of geography, topography, ecology, just the minimum amount of footprint on the land. In fact, it's actually leaves the natural landscape under much of the house, no impervious cover there, puts it up on stilts like that so that the ground and the soil can still breathe and can still absorb water. And then just occasionally where they have to for foundation, they put some intrusion into the landscape there. But it sits very delicately on the land. It also is all about water conservation. You know, we have drought issues in Texas and in California, other places in the United States. But in Australia, they've always had drought that they dealt with. And the eucalyptus tree is this tree that grows big, beautiful forests, but with very little water. But they have to be very careful about conserving water. And of course, here they're out in the middle of freaking nowhere. You don't just like plug into the city water main. There's no water main. So they've got to get their own water here. And very difficult to get groundwater out here because it's very, very, very deep. So the house relies primarily on rainwater collection, even their domestic water, the water to flush their toilets, the water to bathe, the water to cook. Pretty much is collected from rainwater. So that roof is all about collecting water. Every drop of water goes down. There's a gutter on the end here. That gutter takes it to these rainwater storage tanks here. And then it's filtered, and that becomes the domestic water for the house. And that's 100% of the domestic water for the house. Then there also is, when there is a rain, the rain comes down the hill like this, and they actually have a reservoir right there where they filter the water that has come down the hill, and they retain it there. So that's really a retaining pond. And the reason for that is that isn't used for domestic water. That's used in case of a fire, because they have lots and lots of fires in this part of Australia. In fact, eucalyptus trees need fires periodically for a forest to be healthy, because the eucalyptus seed pod won't burst unless there's a fire. So they need periodically to have a fire that comes through, bursts those seed pods, and starts a new generation of eucalyptus trees. So it's in the middle of a forest, and they just let the fires burn. They don't try to keep it from burning. In fact, this is a very bad ecological thing in many American forests, where we try to keep the fires from happening, and that means that the undergrowth gets thicker and thicker and thicker, and that undergrowth becomes fuel, and then when a fire does happen, you get a much hotter fire, and it completely destroys the forest. Whereas if you would let less frequent or more frequent fires happen and burn that underbrush on a regular basis, but never get a fire that's hot enough to really damage the big trees, that's a more natural fire sequence. And so they let that happen in this forest in Australia. So there's going to be a forest fire, and it's going to run through here. And if you don't protect the house against it, your house gets burned down. So instead, they have this reservoir. And then they have a sprinkler system that goes all over the roof of the house. And when it gets to be a certain temperature, it activates that sprinkler system. And it just bathes the entire house in water. And they now have had several major fires that have come through in this area. And the sprinkler system works, and it keeps the house from burning. And it lets the natural fire condition occur with no damage to the human inhabitation. So the water being collected and used for various different purposes. So very responsive to geography, topography, ecology. In terms of structure and materials, probably it's obvious to you. The building is made out of a bending system, primarily out of steel. And they use steel because it's very, very capable in bending. Also, it's a very abundant material in Australia. Australia is one of the biggest steel producers in the world. They have tons of iron ore. They have tons of coke and coal and other things they need to make steel. So it's abundant and it's local. It also could use fairly small pieces because it's so strong, and they could bring them in on a pickup truck. So most of the steel was brought in just on a pickup truck, and it's little bitty pieces of steel. And they're all assembled together, and you can see all that assembly like Tinker Toys, and they all make this thing up into a house. There is a little bit of concrete, which they made on the site and cast there rather than bringing in a concrete truck. But you can see the distinction between the bearing system here for a little bit of the house and the bending system for most of the house. That bending system being just very logical, cantilevering, using the greatest capability you could imagine of all those steel pieces. So climatically, also extraordinary building. Those long faces north and south, short faces east and west, pretty much all of the openings, all the fenestration on the north and south face, breezes, ventilation that goes right straight through the house. It doesn't use high thermal mass so much, but this is not a climate with a very good diurnal swing. So it doesn't really work so much. This is a lightweight house. It's for a hot, humid climate. So it doesn't hold the heat. And it's primarily about shade. And you can see that big roof that has the overhang on the south side and allows you to get some warm sun in the wintertime when they would welcome it. But all through the spring and fall and summer, that big roof keeps all the sun out. Very shady, enveloping roof. There is a fireplace right there that is actually made out of steel, big, thick steel plates. so that when it heats up, it's like a one of those old iron stoves, but and they keep the fire going 24/7 in the winter when it's cold. So that thing just stays warm and radiates the heat out like an old stove would. But instead of making it out of stone, they make it out of steel because it actually radiates more heat that way. Incredible place to live, and a completely energy responsive, resource responsive kind of building. Okay, third example. This one is here in Texas. It's just west of Fort Worth, a little bit south and west of Fort Worth. This is kind of the top of the Texas Hill Country. Very beautiful, beautiful landscape around. There's a guy who's kind of a crazy man. He owned a bunch of pharmaceutical companies, and he would build up a pharmaceutical company, and then he'd sell it to Merck or somebody like that and make a ton of money. And then Merck would show how incapable they were of managing the innovation that his company had done, and they'd start losing money, and then he'd buy it back, pennies on the dollar, and then he would make a lot more money again, and then he would sell it to somebody else for a ton of money. The guy just cycled through these pharmaceutical companies. He was a brilliant, brilliant businessman. But his real passion in life was his ranch out on this land in the middle of Texas. And he was a big hunter. He loved to hunt. But he loved mostly just the relief of being on the land. Now, it's a bit like Christian Mue, the guy who owned Dominus Winery. It's a bit like, maybe an ethos of just respecting nature, enjoying nature. I mean, this is a high-powered, very successful businessman. But he needed that time on his ranch where he was just under the stars, feeling the breeze, looking out to the beautiful landscape. This was inspiring and important to him. Very, very interesting man. And he felt like business people should have that kind of relationship to nature. They need that. They need the perspective you get when you're connected to nature. So he said, I enjoy that so much on my ranch. I want to make a conference center where business people can come from all over the world and they can have their business conferences in this environment that gives them a fresher, more rooted, more connected way of looking at the world. So he figured his ranch was near DFW Airport. People could fly in from anywhere. It's about an hour and a half drive from the airport out to his ranch. So instead of spoiling his ranch, which he just loved, he bought the ranch next door. And he said, I'm going to make it into this conference area for business people. So the ranch next door had a big ranch house on it. It was on the top of a hill here. It sat right there, the big old ranch house. You can see the contours falling off. There's quite a hill there. You can see the contour lines there going up to the top of the hill. And there are these big trees that surrounded the old ranch house. And the trees had grown very big there because for the 50 or 60 years the ranch house was there, they'd watered and the trees had gotten to be these big, beautiful live oak trees. But then the ranch house burned down. So this guy thought he wanted to build the conference center where the old ranch house was. But the architects convinced him, no, leave the top of the hill. Don't occupy that. Go just below the edge of the hill and then look into all those trees instead of being in the middle. And then allow yourself the prospect, the views out, not encumbered by the trees, out to the landscape beyond, just below the edge of the hill. And he like, okay, dude, that sounds like just the right thing to do. So it's again working very much with the land, not dominating the land at the top of the hill, but nestling into the edge of the hill and wrapping around the hill and reiterating the shape of the landscape there. And so there was a wall that's built there and a kind of separation of the top of the hill and then down from that, all of the compound of the various buildings. And it's mostly this is the set of buildings there. That's a pool and a little pool house. There's a little hunting house over here and a fire pit. There are a few little casitas over here, but basically that's the bulk of it. And that's the north arrow, so north is that direction. So this is long faces north and south, short faces east and west, and looking down that hill to a beautiful lake that's on the other side over here. So gorgeous views out in the north, and the building's oriented very much to that. There also, there's the top of the hill there, and there was the big trees right there. But this is kind of a windy area, somewhat like Sea Ranch. And especially when you got to the top of that hill, it's a very, very windy area. So there's a sunken court just on the other side of the tree. There's a little indentation in the land and a sunken court on the south here. So in the wintertime, when the wind is not refreshing, it's just freezing cold, there is a protected place where there's south sun for the heat and there's protection from the wind. And even on a kind of sunny but chilly winter day, there's plenty of place to be outdoors on that side of the building, on the south side of the building, with those big live oak trees, the canopy of them up above you right there. So we're going to be looking at that wall, and you kind of go through the wall to get to various parts of the compound. That's that little hunting house that's nestled in a tree over there and a fire pit. This is the little casitas. Everything is weaved in with the existing trees, so the building sits very gently on the land. And then that's that big wall that kind of separates the top of the hill from the buildings down below. Again, in terms of structure, solid, load-bearing stone wall that does the structural task, and that's in contrast to the lighter, thinner bending members for the walkways and sort of arcades that take you out to the individual rooms out on the wing there. This bearing system is very interesting for the way it's laid up. They actually built stone and made formwork for concrete out of stone. So they would build a four-sided stone volume, pour concrete on the inside. The concrete kind of oozes out to become a cap for that. Then they built the next bit of formwork out of stone, poured the concrete in, made a cap for that, built the next bit of formwork out of stone, poured the concrete in, made a cap for that. And it demonstrates how as the loads collect, fewer loads at the top, greater load as you go down, greater load as you go down, and the shape of the piers reflect the structural role and also reflect the materials that the piers are made out of. And that's in contrast to the heavy solid piers for the bearing members and then the bending members, much lighter and thinner, and in fact, very, very delicately detailed. Just the thinnest, lightest kind of structure where you want the view. So in these views out to the lake where you have a porch out there, the steel is just one support and cantilevered on each side. And then the supports for the handrail, just the thinnest little bit of steel, and the actual rails of the handrail, just wires in tension. Just the very least obtrusiveness to the view. So where you need openness, airiness, lightness, and view, it's the bending, thin, delicate steel system. Where you're rooting it down into the ground, it's the heavier, more bearing system. And that explicit structure is there in the inside of the lodge as well. This is the big kind of central room for the conference center, a huge fireplace made out of that same massive bearing stone. And then the framework for the building made out of wood here, seeing every timber, every joint. It's actually a composite of wood and steel. So there are bending members that are wood. There are tension members that are steel. And all of those are working together to make these big trusses that give a lot of character to that big kind of central lodge space. But again, the structure and materials being very much a part of making the architecture of that space. climatically, again, beautiful representation of response to the climate. As we saw in the site plan, long faces north and south, short faces east and west. Those long north-south faces get all of the glass, all of the glass. The west face here, almost no glass on that side. The south face is generously shaded then with this horizontal sun shading, these great porches created on the south side of the building so that it completely keeps the sun off of that glass and any kind of thermal heat gain that would occur there. So again, it's physical considerations that are substantially inspiring the character of the building, the materials of the building, the spatial quality of the building, accommodating the views, creating energy efficiency, creating good, sensible use of sun and trees and slope and land, all working together. Now, I just want to, at the end here, show maybe some other physical considerations we haven't talked about so much, but how they can have a big impact as well. This is a pretty wacky building on the campus of Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. It's a building by Rem Koolhaas, done a decade or so ago. And this was where there was a physical issue of acoustics. And this was a campus that is split by an elevated railway system. And the elevated railway system has been there since the 19th century. The campus came much later. Sort of half of the IIT campus is on one side of the elevated rail, and half the campus is on the other side. And it tends to be the more dormitory residential part of the campus is on one side of the rail, and the more academic part of the campus is on the other side of the rail. And then there was just kind of a no man's land in between. And they did a big competition to build a new student union, student center, for the campus. And the site they chose was, of course, you'd want it between the residential part of the campus and the academic part of the campus. So they chose a site that was in the area in the middle. And they invited five renowned architects to come and participate in that competition. And four out of the five architects either put the building on the residential side of the rail or they put it on the academic side of the rail. But Rem Koolhaas said, I'm going to put it under the rail so that it just straddled, and functionally it worked very beautifully to both participate in the residential part of the campus and to participate in the academic side of the campus. But then if you decide to do that, you have to worry about the noise that this train makes. And those of you who've been to Chicago and been around that elevated rail, which they call the L, and it runs all over the city, and when you're underneath it, it's just like quack, 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 quack when a train goes over. It's massive noise. So something had to be done to control that physical consideration of the noise from the train. So there's the track running through the campus, and he put this kind of condom on the train that would hold in the noise. And then he slid the building under the building, under the train, and protected it from that. So again, it's the architecture, and it's pretty wacky, big form thing, a very bold move, but it's all made from physical considerations. It's made from dealing with the acoustical problem that was created on that part of the campus. And that big tube is a massive now landmark on the campus, and a really kind of powerful form. So again, physical considerations producing strong architectural form. In the rest of the building, you actually go through and you see this thing, the tube sort of slides through the building. But again, through the building, it's all about physical considerations. This is like the ceiling, and it's sheetrock. And instead of painting the sheetrock, they actually show exactly how the sheetrock's made. They're big sheets of sheetrock, and then there are nail holes, and then they're taping joints, and they're all left exposed, very carefully done and left exposed. But again, it's physical considerations that are making the big move here. This campus was designed by Mies van der Rohe. We looked at it earlier in the semester when we talked about Mies van der Rohe. He did the original plan and buildings on the campus. And so there's actually a picture of Mies van der Rohe's head right here at the major entry point of the building. And it's made out of lots of little pixels that are little emblems of different activities that go on in the building. So it's pretty cool how, again, just he's using it as Frit to control the light, but he's also making an image of Mies van der Rohe. And that also is a sliding door that opens up, and you walk through Mies's mouth right there. But a kind of interesting, jokey thing. All the way through the building about physical considerations. Okay, that's it for today. Do me your Twitter card. Twitter card question again is, what do you think of Lisa Hsiung's book? Three alternatives. One is, I'm enthusiastic. I think it's great. I totally buy it. The second, kind of interesting. The third one, nope, don't agree.
So if Brianna Gibbons is still in the room, could you come up to the front? Brianna Gibbons?